From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. There are 290 Indian casinos in 28 states across the country, and some are hugely profitable. But profitable for who? On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists Donald Bartlett and James Steele about their investigative report for Time magazine on Indian casinos. They found a system full of abuse where a minority of natives are getting rich while the majority are getting nothing. Also, film director Todd Haynes and production designer Mark Friedberg, their new movie Far From Heaven is inspired by Douglas Sirk's melodramas of the 1950s, particularly the film All That Heaven Allows. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate's third-ranking Republican has proposed a meeting of his GOP colleagues in early January to discuss the fate of incoming Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott. This follows a call by the Senate's number two Republican for a vote on ousting Lott from his leadership post. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
As chair of the Senate Republican Conference, Pennsylvania's Rick Santorum has the power to convene a meeting of his fellow GOP senators. Senate sources say he's suggesting they gather the afternoon of January 6th to discuss Lott's fate. That's the day before the opening session of a new Republican-run Senate, in which Lott is to be majority leader. But his claim to that post is now in serious jeopardy due to an outcry over Lott's recent praise of Senator Strom Thurmond's presidential bid as a segregationist in 1948. Santorum has argued that Lott has apologized several times and should remain as leader. But other GOP senators are privately backing the call GOP whip Don Nichols issued Sunday for choosing a new leader. They say the sooner that's done, the better. Some are saying the Republican conference should meet this week to decide Lott's fate. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
Senator Joseph Lieberman said today that he's considering a bid for the Democratic nomination for president following Al Gore's announcement that he will not run. Gore announced his decision yesterday on the CBS program 60 Minutes and repeated it today at a news conference. Lieberman said this morning that he'd make a decision on whether to run within the next couple of weeks. Other potential Democratic candidates praised Gore for his leadership. They included Senate Democratic leader Tom Daschle, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, and Vermont Governor Howard Dean. Secretary of State Colin Powell says the United States has no plans to attack North Korea. But Powell also says the U.S. will not sign a non-aggression pact as North Korea demands. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
North Korea has called for a non-aggression pact amid an escalating nuclear weapons crisis on the Korean Peninsula. The North has admitted reviving a nuclear weapons program and says it plans to restart its nuclear reactors. In response, the U.S. and its allies have suspended fuel aid to the North. Secretary Powell says that while the U.S. has no plans for war, it will not sign a non-aggression pact because that would reward North Korea for violating its commitments on arms proliferation.
It is a difficult situation. It is a dangerous situation. And the way to get away from this situation is for North Korea to comply with its obligations under existing agreements with respect to developing weapons of mass destruction.
Powell says that if there's any concern about war, it's been raised by North Korea's actions. Vicki O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 193 points, or 2.3%, to close at 8,627 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 38 points. This is NPR News. The director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency says he's stepping down. Joe Alba said he'll leave on March 1st when FEMA is scheduled to become part of the Homeland Security Department. Alba was one of President Bush's top aides during the 2000 presidential election. Cardinal Bernard Law spoke publicly today for the first time since he resigned as Archbishop of Boston on Friday. NPR's Duncan Moon reports.
Cardinal Law has kept a low profile since his resignation, avoiding the media and making no public appearances. In reading a prepared statement today, the cardinal apologized and asked forgiveness for his role in mishandling the sexual abuse scandal. But he said he believed the church was now well along in implementing what he described as a comprehensive plan to deal with future sexual abuse cases.
Well, I had hoped to be part of that implementation. It came to be ever more clear to me that the most effective way that I might serve the church at this moment is to resign.
The cardinal said he would now embark on a retreat with other priests before making any decision on what his future role in the church will be. Duncan Moon, NPR News, Washington.
A federal judge in Florida has dismissed a university's lawsuit against one of its professors who's allegedly linked to terrorists. The University of South Florida is seeking to fire Sami Al-Aryan, a tenured computer science professor who's a Palestinian. The university alleges that Al-Aryan raised money for terrorist groups and founded organizations that support terrorism. Al-Aryan has denied any connections to terrorism and has said that he'll sue the university if he's fired. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods. On the web at aecf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Casino gambling on Native American reservations was legalized by Congress in the late 80s. The purpose was to create jobs and help get Native Americans out of poverty. Indian casinos are succeeding in making money. Last year, 290 of them in 28 states pulled in about $12.7 billion in revenue. But according to an investigative report in Time magazine, the profits are making a small percentage of Native Americans rich, while the majority get nothing. My guests, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters Donald Bartlett and James Steele, are the authors of this two-part report. It began last week and continues in this week's edition of Time. To qualify for a casino, you have to be a member of a federally recognized tribe. Bartlett and Steele found several long-defunct tribes were resurrected for the purpose of getting permission to build a casino, and these particular casinos benefit few natives. The most lucrative casinos are near urban areas, but most of the native population lives in rural areas in such states as Oklahoma, Montana, North and South Dakota. The casinos there are not very lucrative. I asked Bartlett and Steele for examples of what they consider the best and worst ways casino profits have been used by tribes. James Steele started with a positive example.
We saw a tribe out in Kansas, west of Kansas City, a fairly good-sized tribe, which has a very successful casino that doesn't disrupt its neighborhood. They plow most of the profits from that casino back into the reservation, into everything from housing to education to senior developments. They're rebuilding the reservation's road network, which had gotten into a very rundown state for a long period of time. They're donating money to some neighboring school districts where children on the reservation go to school. And they're taking a small percentage of the profits from the casino and sending out checks to every member of the tribe. And what is really most impressive about what they do is that it's this nice balance between investing in what you might call community values, the reservation, and also giving a little money to it, to the individual members. And what you find with this particular tribe, it's about a 5,000-member tribe, the Potawatomi Nation. Most of them don't live on the reservation, which is very common across the country and in terms of Indian country. Most have had to find jobs elsewhere because the reservation itself was in such economically difficult straits for many, many years. But what the tribe does, it gives that annual distribution not just to those on the reservation, but to all 5,000 members wherever they may live, because it believes they're all part of the same family.
And an example of profits that you don't think are well spent in terms of the original goal of these casinos, which is helping Native Americans get out of poverty.
Then the other extreme, Terry, is the tribe we write about in part two, the Kickapoo tribe of Texas, which has a reservation down in Eagle Pass along the Mexican border, and they started up the casino. This is a tribe many of whose members speak only limited English. They still speak their ancient language. Most of them speak Spanish. Very poor, very limited education. So the casino goes up. It seems to be doing very well, but the money doesn't, nobody's sure where the money is going after a period of years. And tribal members we interviewed found that said the money was being diverted for a variety of purposes. It was going to run election campaigns. Mr. Garza had run for the U.S. Congress unsuccessfully. His son had run for the state legislature. Money had been spent there. Other money had simply disappeared. It had gone into Mexico, and nobody knows where. The members themselves saw very little benefit from the casino.
Did the members of the tribe try to object to the way the money was being used?
For several years, members of the tribe would raise the objections. They wrote letters constantly to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. They wrote letters to the FBI. They wrote letters to the Interior Department, to other law enforcement agencies. And they simply never got a response.
Now, what about regulation? There's the Bureau of Indian Affairs. There's a Native American Gaming Commission. Have those groups been useful at all in preventing this kind of mismanagement of profits from happening?
The short answer is absolutely not. They've absolutely done nothing. The Bureau of Indian Affairs response is, well, this is an internal tribal matter, and you people have to deal with this yourself. No matter that what's going on is improper conduct, and there's another aspect to this, Terry, that we haven't talked about and may well be the most disturbing, and that is that these reservations in many cases are run like dictatorships. They're run like the old communist bloc countries. Dissent is not acceptable. It's not tolerated. People will be banished from the reservation. People who question what's happening may lose their jobs. They may lose their housing. It's very disturbing.
I want you to talk about Marianne Martin. You describe her as presiding over America's smallest tribe, and she's built a very profitable casino.
Marianne Martin actually didn't even know she was an Indian about 20 years ago. When her grandmother died, she became aware of her Indian heritage. She had been raised as an African-American in Los Angeles, pursued that, and in the early 90s was designated by the Bureau of Indian Affairs as a member of the Augustine Band. At that point, there were no living members of the band. She and her two brothers were designated as members of this tribe of Indians. This was about 1991, and in the years that followed, her two brothers, who were L.A. gang members, were killed in the drug wars of that era. And so she became the only surviving adult member of the Augustine Band. And she began negotiating to put a casino on her reservation in Riverside County in the desert, not far from Palm Springs. And last July, the casino, the Augustine Casino, opened there. And so now she is the one-woman tribe member, proud owner of her very own casino. In addition, when a tribe is recognized, they also qualify for all kinds of government assistance. So Marianne Martin is also qualified and received several hundred thousand dollars in federal aid for housing to run her tribal government for the one adult. There are seven children there. She had three, and four she took from her two brothers' families to raise them also. So in time, you know, you will have eight adults, but that's the extreme situation of Indian gaming.
So who profits from the casino in this very small tribe?
Well, you know, she will profit, and also the investors. And this is a Las Vegas company, Paragon Gaming, headed by Diana Bennett, who's the daughter of William Bennett, who developed the Circus Casino on the Las Vegas Strip. And she, in turn, had investors in other sections of the country who put up money as well to help bankroll this project.
So the picture that you're painting is that some of the casinos are run by tribes that are almost tribes in name only because they represent so few people, and that the profits go to very few people. Instead of benefiting a large number of Native Americans, they go to this very small tribe, and they go to the backers and the investors of this casino. Let's talk a little bit about these peripheral people who profit from the Native American casinos. How do the investors typically figure into this?
Most of the names are not known names. They're people, folks I've never heard of. You've certainly got some Las Vegas and Atlantic City folks involved now, from Donald Trump to certainly Harrah's and so forth. But But most of the people in the early years who backed a lot of these from the early 90s on were names that nobody's ever heard of. And one of the most intriguing ones to us is a Malaysian billionaire who's now 85 years old, a fellow by the name of Lim Gotong, who financed Foxwoods, which is the biggest casino not only in the United States, but the biggest casino in the world happens to be the casino of the Mashantucket Pequot tribe in Connecticut. He put together a deal, loaned them the money, and also took a cut of the profits that will last until, well, in roughly around 2018, it's our understanding. We calculated that he and his family and various companies that he's associated with will probably profit to the extent of about $1 billion over the life of those agreements. But again, nobody knows for the most part about these people. They go on a case-by-case basis, project-by-project basis. They take 30% very often, the managers do, of these casinos once they're up and running, in return for running them and for backing them. And the other thing they do, which was absolutely fascinating to us, they don't just supply the money to build the building. They take on the whole process. They finance the lawyers. They finance the lobbyists. They hire the genealogists in many cases if the tribe has to reestablish itself and show what its lineage is over time. They pay the rent on the tribal offices. They pay the salary or the consulting fees for the tribe's public relations officer if they have one. They take over the entire market basket of things the tribe needs to go online and have a casino.
My guests are Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters Donald Barlett and James Steele. The second half of their investigative series on Indian casinos is in this week's edition of Time Magazine. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are investigative reporters Donald Barlett and James Steele. They're editors-at-large at Time Magazine, and they've written a two-part investigative series on Native American casinos. Are there feuds going on now between the casino-rich tribes and the casino-poor tribes?
There certainly are, and one of the most, it's not a full-fledged feud, but one of the most interesting ones of these is up in Minnesota. One of the most successful Indian casinos in the country is right outside of Minneapolis. It's called Mystic Lake. The Shakopee, Mittewoc, and Sioux, which is a tribe of roughly about 300 members, has this casino. This casino generates hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue every year, and every member of that tribe has done very, very well. To the far north in Minnesota, you have a tribe such as the Red Lake Band of Chippewa, which has roughly 10,000 members, and three small casinos that, if they make any money, it's a very modest amount of money. The tribe in the north tried to partner with the state of Minnesota to open a casino somewhere in the Twin Cities area to basically make some money, because their casinos in the north will never make the kind of money that ones near a big city will. And they were opposed in that by the Shakopee, Mittewoca, and another large tribe right outside Minneapolis and St. Paul, who did not want to see in any way certainly the proceeds they were deriving from gambling interfered with. So that's one fight that you see going on. It's a low-keyed one. It hasn't had much publicity. But you see things like this all over the country, where the have tribes are resisting efforts to share with the have-not tribes.
And Terry, to put that tribe in perspective, each member of that Shakopee tribe gets an annual dividend check exceeding $1 million. The last one was very close to, I guess, to about $1.5 million.
I think one of the sad things that we have seen on a number of these reservations, that's the kind of problem that would have been inconceivable a number of years ago, and that is in some tribes, especially some of the small tribes, they have decided to, some are disenrolling members, some are not letting in people who are truly part of the family, because the tribal councils have the power and the control to be able to do that. So you have the situation, and we focused on one in part one, a tribe out in outside of Fresno, which has an extremely profitable casino. And there are roughly about 100 members of that tribe who now share somewhere between $300,000 and $400,000 a year in various dividends from that casino. There's an equal number, actually slightly fewer number, of folks who are related to them, their cousins, their daughters, sons, their aunts, uncles, all of whom were out of that same area over the years, do not share in those profits because that particular tribal council has made decisions that have restricted the membership. And we found this all over the country. And actually, since that first article appeared that talked about that particular tribe and what they're going through, we've had calls from all over the country, other Indian tribes of folks who've gone through the same thing.
One of your concerns, the Indian casinos, is that you think it's basically getting the government off the hook because the government can feel confident, the American people can feel confident. They have a system in place that's supposed to be helping Native Americans, these casinos, where you help yourself through capitalism. But the reality is that these casinos aren't helping the majority of Native Americans, so that the confidence that American people and the American government can feel about the help it's giving Native Americans is unfounded.
It's absolutely unfounded, and I think it's one of the things that sort of interested us so much when we got into this subject, because there is this perception that tribes are being helped, and the ones that are being helped, of course, are really being helped, but the vast bulk certainly aren't. And it's one of the reasons we think the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act needs to be revisited. There are a number of ideas that are bandied about what the solutions might be. But the main thing is it needs to have some more focus on actually who's benefiting from this, who has the likelihood of benefiting from this. There are all of these glitches in the picture that we were totally unaware of when we got into this. And I think most Americans have no idea exactly what's happening in this field.
Do you see the story as fundamentally breaking down to being a story about good guys and bad guys, or do you see it as a story about a system that doesn't work?
It's more really the latter, though. There are a lot of good guys and bad guys in here as well. But it's mainly a system that's broken down. I mean, it's easy in retrospect to see how the 1988 Act, the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, could not have worked the way some people wanted it to work. And, of course, now many of the tribes are taking the position that it really was not about regulating gaming. It was about sovereignty, about building up tribal governments. But the fact of the matter is that's a certain kind of retrospect. It was largely to regulate gaming. It was in part to develop economic institutions on reservations. And on the latter, for the very small tribes with the rich casinos, it's worked wonderfully. But it's affected only a tiny percentage of the Native American population.
And I think when you talk about the good guys, bad guys, certainly at the beginning you probably can't make that case, but you certainly can now, because Congress has just refused to look at this issue. You have a very few lone voices on Capitol Hill. Frank Wolf of Virginia, the Republican congressman, I mean, he's like a voice crying in the wind. Nobody pays any attention to him, but he's tried to bring this issue up time after time after time. And the other members of Congress simply aren't interested in it.
And the campaign finance reform so widely touted here over the last year basically does not apply to Indian tribes, which is one of those exceptions that has not gotten a lot of great publicity either.
Why doesn't it apply to Indian tribes?
Because while soft money applies to all groups, there's an exception which was basically decreed by the Federal Election Commission that lets basically individual members of the tribe contribute as much as they want to individual candidates.
So are candidates making a lot of money right now from Native American casino profits?
They have been, particularly in California, as Don was saying. The money that's flowing out there is astonishing. Indian tribes are now the largest special interest in that state. You go back a decade, they were barely a blip on the sort of the special interest radar screen. Now they contribute more, they give more than such legendary special interest groups as the trial lawyers and the doctors. They're number one out there simply because there is so much cash flowing through those operations.
Was this a hard piece to write in the sense that, you know, you're writing about Native Americans and you're writing about corruption within the casino system on Native American reservations. And I'm sure you have a lot of sympathy for Native Americans who have had, you know, their land taken from them and their rights taken from them, are now struggling to make a living. And here you are bringing bad news about what goes on in the Native American casino industry. I'm sure, you know, I'm projecting here, but I imagine it's bad news you didn't really want to bring. So I'm just wondering if there were a lot of landmines in writing about the story that made it very difficult.
I think you put your finger on something that's very important. I think in no small part, this attitude is why the situation is spinning out of control as it is, because there is a reluctance to, there's a great deal of sympathy out there. I mean, the way this country has dealt with the Indians over 200 years is, what can you say about it? On the other hand, when you see close up the way individual tribe members are being treated by their own people, it was, in that sense, a very easy story to write, because that this is permitted to go on in this country is an absolute disgrace. And it's allowed to go on, and this is a case where, because those tribal governments in a position to do so simply assert sovereign immunity, and everybody else backs off. And you cannot imagine the pressure that is put on ordinary Indians living on reservations. We've been inundated with phone calls since this piece ran. Very, very, very few publications write about this. A few alternative newspapers, interestingly, have. And one of the things that struck Jim and I, there was an alternative paper in Arizona that told the plight of one Indian woman. And you read the story and you said, okay, that's really interesting. And then the next week's issue is filled with letters saying, thank God someone came to tell our story. And so in that sense, this was really a very easy part of the story to write.
It also was easy to write when we realized how few were benefiting, and when we realized how few would ever benefit under the current regulatory setup, then it became an easier thing to deal with the imperfections of the system.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Nice to be with you, Terry.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Donald Bartlett and James Steele have written a two-part series on Native American casinos for Time magazine. Part two is in this week's edition. The chairman of the National Indian Gaming Association has written a letter to Time in response to the report, suggesting that the magazine has tried to manufacture scandal to sell magazines. The association says that casinos have created over 300,000 jobs, and more than 200 of the roughly 340 Indian tribes in the lower 48 states use Indian gaming to generate tribal government revenue. Indian gaming has built schools, health clinics, and funded college scholarships. The letter also argues that the fact that the Indian Gaming Commission has yet to discover any major cases of corruption is a testament to the upstanding job done by its regulatory personnel. Time magazine stands by its report. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of A Singular Hostage, a novel set in 19th century India by Thalassa Ali. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with film director Todd Haynes and production designer Mark Friedberg. Their new movie, Far From Heaven, is inspired by Douglas Sirk melodramas of the 50s, but it explores themes that couldn't be shown in the 50s, like homosexuality and interracial romance. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're listening to the theme Elmer Bernstein composed for the new movie Far From Heaven. The theme just won the LA Film Critics Association Award for Best Music Score. If it seems to have a 1950s sound, that's intentional. The movie is set in the 50s, and it's an homage to Douglas Sirk's melodramas of that decade. Far From Heaven stars Julianne Moore and Dennis Quaid as a seemingly perfect couple. He's an executive, she's a beautiful wife and mother who keeps an impeccable home. But beneath the surface, things are turning sour. He is a repressed homosexual who can no longer bear physical contact with his wife. She is falling in love with a very intelligent and sensitive gardener who is African-American. Julianne Moore just won the Best Actress Award from the LA Film Critics Association for Far From Heaven and the new film The Hours. Here's a scene from Far From Heaven at a cocktail party in the couple's home. She is serving drinks. He has had too many. But the guests still believe in the facade.
Oh, by golly, there she is now, the prettiest gal in the room.
Oh, Stan, liquor brings out the Texan in you. I hope Eleanor isn't listening.
So what if she is? I still say Frank is the luckiest guy in town.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all smoke and mirrors, fellas. That's all it is. You should see her without her face on.
Frank? No, he's absolutely right. We ladies are never what we appear, and every girl has her secrets.
I'll say.
How about this girl going and getting her husband another drink?
Darling, don't you think you've already had it?
No, I don't think I've had it.
I'd just like to take a moment to raise a glass to our marvelous host and hostess and another glorious annual party at the Whitakers. To Frank and Kathy. Truly, Mr. and Mrs. Magnetech.
Yeah. My guest Todd Haynes wrote and directed Far From Heaven. His other films include The Velvet Goldmine, Safe, and Poison. Later we'll meet the film's production designer, Mark Friedberg. Todd Haynes, welcome back to Fresh Air. Are there specific Douglas Sirk films that you're paying homage to in Far From Heaven?
Yeah, there's definitely a film that we looked at probably more than the others, and it's a film that's not quite as well known as his really famous and wonderful films, Imitation of Life and Written on the Wind. It's a film called All That Heaven Allows with Jane Wyman and Rock Hudson, and it was a follow-up to his first huge hit, the film that made Rock Hudson a star, called The Magnificent Obsession. But All That Heaven Allows is great because it has a much quieter domestic kind of setting and theme. It's really just simply about the divorced older woman who strikes up a romance with the sort of visionary gardener played by Rock Hudson, and the sort of subsequent crises that ensue, you know, in the rigid town. And people who know Far From Heaven will already see big similarities.
It's quite a scandal because he's a much younger man.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, people think of 50s melodramas as being hopelessly dated and even unintentionally campy in their soap opera-like plots. What do you love about the stories?
I guess Sirk brings a certain kind of acuity to his look at American sort of bourgeois middle class life, you know, at that time. In fact, when he talks about in interviews in the late 60s, when he talks about this period of his filmmaking, he's surprised that people feel sentimental about his films at all. But there is a sort of critique that he's playing out visually, and that kind of works against the grain of the sentimentality. And I think it's one of the reasons why his films remain really interesting to people today.
No, the taboo that's explored in the Sirk movie, All That Heaven Allows, is, you know, an older woman falling in love with a younger man and he falling in love with her. You've built your plot in Far From Heaven around a couple of things that were so taboo in the 50s you couldn't even have shown them in the 50s. One in your film is that the husband realizes that he's really gay, and his wife, who is white, falls in love with an African-American. You couldn't have shown that in the 50s. Did you intentionally go for things that you knew would have been taboo in the 50s?
It was a balancing act, I think, in my thinking when I was writing the script. And because on the one hand, yes, I'm exploring, I think the theme that's absolutely impossible, it would have been impossible to depict at that time, would be the gay themes that Dennis Quaid's character struggles through. The racial themes, there were actually some amazing films from the 50s and even the late 40s that got pretty close to some of the themes we explore in Far From Heaven. But more, I think, rather than it being a film about, you know, that takes on the 50s style but ventures into places 50s films wouldn't have gone, I think what's almost more weird and noteworthy about it is how restrained, that we impose the same restraint on these kinds of themes that you would see from films at that time. And in fact, I think it actually makes the themes and the events in the film stronger because they're so sort of minimally excavated. They're really, we're just touching on the bits of information that you need to know without really fully delving into what Quaid's sexual quest is all about and what really happens to him behind closed doors.
Now, the two films that Cirque made with Jane Wyman and Rock Hudson, Magnificent Obsession and All That Heaven Allows, they have happy endings. Your film doesn't.
No.
If I'm not giving away too much by saying that.
No.
Was that a conscious decision that things were not going to be resolved in a happy way?
Yeah, it definitely was. I mean, one interesting thing about Cirque, and he writes about this, is that he was very well aware that his endings were insufficient and that they left you kind of wanting, and they didn't really resolve the conflicts that his films explored. So they were kind of false happy endings, as he described them. And I like that idea, but I think at a certain level, Terry, I wanted to make a movie that really did make people cry, that really got under your skin in ways you might not see coming as it starts out, and that you really feel caught up in. And so for me, it had to have a sort of more hopeless ending.
So instead of saying, well, society is repressive, but love conquers all, and people, when you scratch beneath the surface, are basically good, your film is saying society is really repressed, and there can virtually be no real happy endings in such a repressive society.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what's lovely about these kinds of films is the onus is put onto the society. That's the villain in these films. There's no individual that you could sort of single out and say, oh, without that person involved, everything would be fine. The best melodramas really are ones that find really ordinary people caught up in very simple, tangles of need. And when those needs aren't fulfilled, or when somebody takes a sort of a slightly dangerous step outside of the prescribed options, everybody suffers. And I think that's just more true to how we all experience our lives and the constraints that we live under.
Let's talk about the look of your film, Far From Heaven. Did you want it to have that 50s, I mean, obviously you did want it to have that 50s Technicolor look that Douglas Sirk's films had.
Yeah, absolutely. What's really amazing about almost I imagine almost any chapter of interesting Hollywood filmmaking that you go back to and you really focus on and dissect and analyze is that you'll learn a whole wealth, a whole new language, basically, languages that have often just sort of disappeared from our vernacular today, that are beautiful, rich, languages of color and decor and costume and but they serve the story. They're not separate from what these kinds of stories are and what they're trying to express. So to us, it was a language that was absolutely particular to the kind of story we were making. It wasn't like we were just imposing a 50s style on some plot.
Let me bring Mark Friedberg into the conversation. He's the production designer for All That Heaven Allows and also was production designer for the films The Ice Storm, Runaway Bride, and Pollock. Mark, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So when you started working with Todd Haynes on Far From Heaven, did you go back and watch Douglas Sirk films? Had they been important to you before making this film?
They had been films I had seen, but I hadn't ever really watched them for what they had to offer visually, at least as far as the work I had been doing.
What struck you most when you watched them as research for Far From Heaven?
Well, it was when we, as Todd said, when we dissected them, when we took them apart, what was most striking about them was actually how theatrical the worlds that these characters lived in were, how emotional, almost, you could say, by virtue of the fact that all the visual elements were heightened. And we got very involved in really, I think, a very vibrant palette of complementing colors and color temperatures that sort of allowed there to be provided a tension visually, I think, that very much underscored the tension that the characters were feeling.
So you saw the visual vibrance of the film and the saturated colors as being in intentional contrast to the repressed emotions that the characters have.
It's almost that, in a way, for me, it became almost that, by, you know, the characters are so stuck with their own emotions, so unable to do anything with the true emotions that they feel, that they almost had to come out through in the world that they lived in, that they mm-hmm. saturated themselves into the world that they were, the place that these characters were living in. I mean, we also were creating a world that was specific to this family at their economic level at that time in the world, but was very sort of particular to the 50s, in fact, when it was really an ideal. And we were creating, an idealized sense of what this world might be.
My guests are Mark Friedberg, the production designer of the new film Far From Heaven, and Todd Haynes, the film's writer and director. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Todd Haynes, the writer and director of the new film Far From Heaven, and Mark Friedberg, the film's production designer. When we left off, Friedberg was saying that the vivid and idealized world they've created in the film is an intentional contrast to the repressed emotions of the main characters. Describe the world a little bit by describing their home. And this is a couple, you know, she's the perfect housewife, and he is an executive at Magnatech, which is like a fledgling television company.
The home, I think, is very much an extension, or at least we looked at it as an extension of Kathy's world, in that truly it's her story, even though a lot happens to these other characters. As well, we were creating a set, I think, that spoke to the history of sets. We quite often create worlds where you really don't want to notice that they exist, that they seem very natural to the place, that they seem very naturally the place where their characters are living. And I think we were trying to create that, but also a place that you recognized as a setting, as almost one step removed from what it might actually really be.
Kind of an ideal, almost wish fulfillment of what women at this particular time aspired to. What's so fun, what was great with Mark and I, is just this sort of ridiculous loop that we took, where we're not really making a film about Hartford, Connecticut in 1957. We're making a film about how a Hollywood soundstage backlot mentality would interpret Hartford in 1957. But of course, we were a low-budget, independent production that had to apply these kinds of demands on what was half a location shoot in New Jersey and half a soundstage, a shoot on a beautifully built set that Mark designed.
What was it about the soundstage look that you wanted?
Everything. I mean, the control. I mean, I think the best possible thing is to settle on the stage finally after the craziness of location shooting and be in a controlled setting, where the kind of detail we were looking at in terms of the architecture of space and the ways that literally Mark could construct a set that would set up the kinds of shots of a kind of claustrophobia at times, where there'd be oppositional high and low angles, but he could actually build steps that go down into the living room and then, or go up into the living room and they go further up into the music room, and then we could place characters on these various levels and intensify those high low oppositions so the ceiling feels like it's looming down over characters. Or, you know, it was just an amazing opportunity for me to construct an architecture that would support the aesthetic kind of suggestions that we were trying to make visually in the film.
Color is really important in the film. The colors are very saturated, very rich. Did you have like a color a color code that you went into this with? Like, talk a little bit about how you chose the color themes for different scenes and for different characters.
Yeah, color was sort of everything in this film, and it started in a sort of intuitive way with myself just going through the scenes and creating these sort of spectrums of colors with color swatches that were ways I could start to communicate the moods I was looking for to the creative departments. And then I'd sit down with Mark and Sandy Powell, the costume designer, and Ed Lockman, the director of photography, and we'd sit for really days and meticulously go through the film and begin to talk about these sort of almost, you know, unverbalizable issues about color. And the cue that Mark was talking about earlier that we took from Cirque was that his use of color was so much more subtle and complex than you see in movies today, where color is sort of one note application of blue is sad or scary and warm, you know, yellow gold is happy or nostalgic. There was always complementary colors. There was always warms and cools interacting in his frames, you know. And it just deepened and made more, I think, subtle and rich this emotional themes of the film. And so that was our strategy. And we talked about ways that warms and cools would kind of develop as in opposition to each other. And sometimes the warms would be dominant and Kathy would be in the one cool color in the scene. Or, you know, we'd place characters in opposition to the general thing. Or it would just be the use of light and decor interacting.
Is there a specific scene where you can describe how the colors are used and what you think it does to the experience of watching the movie?
Well, I mean, one of the things we learned from Cirque specifically was the way he enhanced the perception of night, especially as it's seen through a window. And in the scene with Dennis Quaid and Julianne on the couch after the party, the blueness of the night, it looms there, and it's ominous, and but it's also beautiful and enticing at the same time. And that's one example where it's a little bit on the nose. But the other thing that we often did with color was, as we did in that scene, was while there may be a dominant blue theme somewhere going on in the frame, we also complemented that with a warm somewhere else. And I think that's what gives the movie its vibrancy. It's not just that there's bold colors, but it's the way that colors are used in conjunction and in opposition to one another. As a sort of different, you know, in ways that can both create attention or soothe a moment.
Todd, did you use any rear projection in the movie?
Oh yeah, we did. We did in the classic, for people who don't really know what that is, the basic way that people identify it is in the old-fashioned projected screen behind the car shot, where if you visited Universal Studios, you'd get to climb into the half car, and they'd turn the screen on of the street going by, and you'd feel like just one of those old-fashioned movies.
Instead of you driving in the car,
yes,
you're sitting still in a car, but there's a film behind you of the scenery passing by, so it looks like you're actually driving, but that's just an optical illusion.
Exactly. And what's funny is rear projection is still used today in action films and in a lot of ways, very subtly, and it doesn't call attention to itself in ways that a contemporary audience might notice in old films. But we wanted to have that kind of beautiful artifice in a lot of places in this film. And so what was really exciting is we actually rummaged through with some great research people and got our hands on the actual rear projection plates, the films from Cirque, from Written on the Wind.
Wow, you're kidding.
That Dorothy Malone is driving her bright red, you know, sports car. We have that backdrop plate. So when Julianne Moore is leaving her house after the NAACP kids come by knocking on her door and she's going to drive past Raymond's Garden Shop, the first rear projection that you see is actually from Written on the Wind.
That's amazing. It was a thrill to find it.
Oh God, it was such a pivotal moment for us. And it was actually our very last day of shooting that we did all the rear projection stuff. So it was kind of a nice culmination to the whole experience.
Can you tell that that's from a different, that was shot in a different decade and shot by a different person? I mean, I certainly didn't notice something sticking out like that.
I don't know. What do you think, Mark? I couldn't tell particularly.
No, I don't think I could tell. I mean, there were a few places where we used old-fashioned tricks, and in some cases it was simply because that was what was most affordable. But actually, my most exciting moment on the film came on the second-to-last day of shooting, when we had to create the sea outside of the Miami restaurant. And we had all kinds of complicated and technical ways of doing it, but what we ultimately ended up affording was a large piece of blue cloth with cellophane sequins and a couple of fans. And it's the most beautiful sea I think I've ever been a part of.
My guests are Mark Friedberg, the production designer of the new film Far From Heaven, and Todd Haynes, the film's writer and director. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Todd Haynes, the writer and director of the new film Far From Heaven, and Mark Friedberg, the film's production designer. Todd Haynes, let's talk about the acting in the movie. Julianne Moore is the star of the film, and she is pregnant. She was pregnant when you shot the film.
Yeah.
And you can kind of tell. I mean, she's wearing skirts that are especially full. She has a kind of bigger waistline than you remember her having in previous films. But everything, you know, she's wearing baggy coats some of the time. But it still works. How did she break the news to you after you cast her that she was actually pregnant?
We were in pre-production, and we were already having a beset with a lot of whatever conflicts just in getting the commitment to the money that we felt the film required at the most minimal level to get made. And then all of a sudden we hear Julianne Moore is pregnant, and that she will probably be close to 6 months pregnant by the time we finish the film, you know. And there was no way of changing. The schedule was completely built around the fall, the leaves. We needed those leaves. And so there was no way to start earlier or obviously go later. That would have been much harder. So it was really the person to really talk to about how hard this was is Sandy Powell, the costume designer, who was not happy about it and had planned.
But I think ultimately on some level, it kind of gave Julianne a more period appearance.
Absolutely.
I think that,
I mean, like
that
a
was
fuller,
what Sandy,
a fuller figure, like, yeah, like movie stars tended to have.
Yeah.
And that was Sandy's brilliance, but she actually made it work for herself.
I agree. And she's bosomy. I mean, she's beautiful bosoms, and she's glowy. And I think Julianne Moore looks so amazingly beautiful in this film. A lot of it is how beautiful she is. A lot of it is very careful lighting that Ed Lockman really tried to emulate the Hollywood lighting. But she's glamorously photographed, and she really glows, and it all really does serve the character and the period.
How does her look in the clothing that she's wearing compared to what you had in your mind when you first cast her?
I have to say it really is what I pictured, you know. I mean, maybe she's just a little fuller formed because I just don't think of her that way normally. She's, when you meet Julie, she's tiny and lovely, you know. But she glows, and she looks womanly. And there's that very scene Mark was talking about of Dennis on the couch after the party, with the blue moonlight coming in, when she's trying to comfort him, she's leaning across the couch, and her bosoms form these sort of this voluptuous torpedo toward him. And of course, he's cowering in intimidation around his heterosexuality. And here is this swath of cloth, you know. And then her bum is also like this big, beautiful wrap of the sort of satiny cloth, picking up the moonlight and also interacting with the maroon color of the fabric. And it's just, I mean, it's just an amazing image, I think, and it has a lot to do with the costume and a lot to do with the setting, but a lot to do with her physical state at the time.
Do you think that having made this movie and just kind of drenched yourself in a 1950s approach to movie making with rear projection and working with sound stages and so on, do you think that's going to carry over into subsequent, into future films that you each make?
I don't know. Every film I've made, I think, has been its own kind of delving into a sort of genre and all of the stylistic associations that come with that genre. And for me, they're always learning processes about the period I'm looking at. My film I did before Far From Heaven was called Velvet Goldmine. It was about the glam rock era in the 70s, but it was as much about the kind of drug culture movies that were coming out in the late 60s that I loved as a teenager, and that brought with them a whole set of stylistic terms as well, and that we just dove into, you know, as much as it was about clothes and music, it was about the way the camera works and what the colors were and what the style was of this particular kind of storytelling. So for me, each one becomes an opportunity just to learn more and continue to stretch myself and see the relationship between style and content and how one, they're sort of in the best films that you can't separate them.
Mark?
Well, what I was so struck by is how different this world is from my aesthetic and how much I ended up loving this aesthetic or this the way this looks. I'm actually quite worried what's going to happen to me.
Well, I want to thank you both for talking to us about Far From Heaven. Todd Haynes, Mark
thank
Friedberg,
you,
thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Todd Haynes wrote and directed the new film Far From Heaven. Mark Friedberg is the film's production designer. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, committed to serving Lutherans, their families, and communities with financial strategies and customer-focused service, online at thrivent.com, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, film critic John Powers talks about some of the new movies opening for the holidays, like Scorsese's Gangs of New York, Spielberg's Catch Me If You Can, an adaptation made by the team that made Being John Malkovich. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.